Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Dugout Debate podcast. This week, we chat about getting rid of the excess lockdown mass and replacing it with cold, hard gains. Joining myself and Chris today is Charlie Faulkner, our friend from distant past and Chris's former WASP colleague. Charlie has a diverse background in strength and conditioning, so we'll be grilling him today on his career so far, the current developments in S&C, as well as much, much more. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
So, yeah, Charlie was a friend of ours from school. There's a theme here, isn't there? We have lots of good friends in high places in sporting backgrounds. Anyway, Charlie, just give us a quick rundown of your background, what happened to you after school, what you're doing now, and how you got there.
Yeah, so I guess I kind of took a bit of a weird journey after I finished sick form. Most people went to university. I went straight into retail and was working full-time in retail for 2 years. During that 2 years, I decided that I ended up wanting to go to university. I wanted to study strength and conditioning, so I applied for the undergrad course at St. Mary's University and went there in 2014. And in conjunction with that, I was doing some volunteer work down at a gym in Weybridge called Locker 27, where it's, I guess, where I started my my journey as a coach while I was doing my degree. So I spent 3 years at St. Mary's while working at Locker 27 as well. And then I got offered a role working at WASPs, is where I kind of came in contact with Chris again. So I was working with the academy there in my second and third year at university, where I was looking after the under 18s and under 16s, so the junior academy. And then I also actually took on a role with water polo. So I did Great Britain's under 16s water polo squad for a year in my third year at uni. So I was trying to juggle my dissertation in my third year, all my PT clients at Locker 27, finished university. I left WASPs in, I think it was 2018, January 2018. And then I went full time at Locker. So I was just working with PT clients, building a business there. And then October of last year, I got offered a role at the Lawn Tennis Association. So since then, I've been working with British Tennis and a couple of their players. And at the same time, I'm currently doing my master's in strength and conditioning at St. Mary's as well. So I've got one more year left on that. And that's where I am today. So awesome. Pretty different to what most people have done, I guess.
Yeah. So, like, even though you were a bit delayed at the beginning, like, you're still going to have smashed out a undergrad degree and a master's in that time, as well as apparently working with every sports team under the sun, at least at academy level, and doing master's on top of that. That's pretty impressive. What was interesting was you worked while doing your S&C stuff. Do you think that really helped your progression as an operator, as an S&C coach? Would you recommend that to people who are doing the same thing or thinking about doing the same thing?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I was definitely in a fortunate position where the guys down at Locker 27 really allowed me to get that hands-on coaching experience, which is very hard to get. And I was very fortunate amongst a lot of my peers in being able to get that sort of experience, because, it allows you to apply what you've learned in the classroom into practice with athletes and with people you're working with. And yeah, that was Locker was the place where I kind of learned how to interact with people and get what I want from them and be able to apply all that stuff I learned at university into that setting. So yeah, you have all your coaching side of it and then you have your technical side. They come together. You can't have one without the other, if that makes sense.
How about you just talk us through what your role was at WASPs and the water polo? Just give us a little bit more detail about what you've done.
Yeah, cool. So at WASPs, I joined in the summer and started working with the DPP group, which was the Developing Players Program. So that was kind of the under 13s, under 14s, under 15s. So I did that part time. That was every Monday evening, where I'd go up to Oxford and deliver strength and conditioning curriculum to those players, those three age groups. And then the year after, I moved up to a more senior role, but it was still like an intern, but working with the under 18s and the under 16s, where that would be, again, it was still part time, but the responsibility was a little bit more, where I would be writing some of the programs and then getting mentored by a strength conditioner. You'll know him, Chris, Ian Taplin. So I owe a lot to him as well. But yeah, we would then deliver all their strength conditioning programs. I was based at Henley College, which was the ACE college at the time. And then we would go and deliver warm-ups and stuff on match days as well. So it was part of the match day support for the under 18 league as well. And then the water polo was a different challenge in itself, because it was a remote program. So it was decentralized. The players would be spread out across the country. And then every 6 to 8 weeks, I would travel up to Manchester and we'd have camps. So we did, I think, 3 or 4 camps in Manchester. And then we had an overseas camp in Malta in prep for the European qualifiers, which were in Manchester, in May in Manchester of the same or the following year. So that was kind of a 1 year kind of project where just basically took these players from having no sort of strength and conditioning background to giving them a level of competency where they could apply what we were doing in the gym within their setting in the pool.
And what are you doing now?
So now at LTA, I'm working with a group which we are on our pro scholarship program. So that would be any player that the country that it, well, as part of British Tennis, that are going to potentially get into the top 100 that will be put on the program. And then we offer them support from a physical point of view, from a rehab point of view. And then we have contact with the coaches as well around how we can supplement their progression to get into the top 100. And that will be a lot of traveling. So obviously a lot of tennis is played abroad throughout the different parts of the season. So a lot of my time would have been spent traveling up until coronavirus, but supporting players, we call it on the road, and then obviously back at base when we're back in the country. So that's kind of where I am now.
So in terms of like your day-to-day life across the different specialisms, different sports that you've been in, the sort of outputs that you're trying to get from the athletes are fundamentally quite different with all those different sports. So I'm presuming that on a day-to-day basis, the kind of programs you're giving these guys are going to be completely different. So what sort of processes do you go through when you're thinking up programs, if that makes sense, or thinking up the kind of things that you need to do with the athletes to try and develop them physically?
Yeah, so great question. It's massively evolved over the past, I'd say, 6 months to a year in terms of my processes around what athletes need and how to go about delivering that. But I guess to answer a question from the top, I was asking what is the outcome of the program. So what do we want to be able to see from the athletes in their sport, and then breaking it down from there to try and get it to have as much clarity as we can around how simple we can make it. So, for example, if an athlete is if they report very slow on our tests, so we could say that right, their acceleration is poor, we can work on acceleration. So it's breaking that down even further to being okay, so what components of acceleration do we want to change, and being very specific with that. So is it potentially we're trying to improve hip extension torque or knee extension torque, and then how can we go, what's the best method that we can fit in with that physical outcome to achieve what we want to achieve? And then obviously we'll hold ourselves accountable and be like, right, over the next 6 to 8 weeks, this is the sort of changes we want to see to be meaningful. And then when we retest, this is what we expect us, or what we take a hunch of their testing score to be. And then on court, this is what we, in tennis, for example, this is what we'd expect them to be able to do now. So I guess that's the sort of process.
So I don't know why I didn't think about this, but a lot of the stuff you're doing is completely data-driven then? Like you do baseline stuff or...?
Yeah, so I'd say it's partly data-driven, but I'd use the term more informed. So the data will inform where we go with our practice. So it allows us to have a more, I won't say holistic, but a bigger picture of what the athlete's doing and how they're doing it. And then obviously the most important thing is making sure that what I'm trying to do from a strength and conditioning point of view is aligned with what the coach wants to see from the player. So the tests that we do will just allow us to look at the athlete in a little bit more detail to provide a bigger picture of where we want to take them and where we can get, I guess, the best bang for our buck in terms of training, where we can focus our training on.
So there's sort of a divvy up of your time where, you know, if an athlete's got a glaring weakness in some place, you're better off focusing on that. Whereas if they're more all-rounded and they're just little defects here and there, then you'll have to focus on something specific that's most likely to get better gains. Is that sort of...
Yeah, exactly. Like if they've got recurring injuries, then obviously we need to make sure that we're implementing injury prevention programs or rehab programs that allow them to recover and allow them to be stronger in that area, so that isn't a limiting factor and there is a reduced risk of injury going forward. But again, like I said, ultimately it comes down to having clarity over what the outcome of the program is and making sure that that is aligned with the philosophy of the coach and what they want from the player.
Like you've clearly had quite a sort of diverse career, even in a short amount of time, with the type of athletes that you have, from sort of relatively young guys to guys who are pushing the elite spectrum at the top end of the sport. In terms of your relationships with the athletes and the buy-in you get from them, sort of how difficult is it to adjust from athlete to athlete, or what kind of difficulties have you found with, say, younger kids versus the older guys who are more experienced and that sort of thing?
Yeah, so it's massively different, and actually it's probably flipped in terms of the younger guys who are a lot more willing and compliant with what you're trying to do. And I put that down to, especially at WASP, the fact that they're in an academy and they're at WASP, so they think, right, I'm playing for an academy, I'm under 18s, I could potentially play for the first team. So they're more willing and engaging and not as reluctant to buy in. So it's quite easy with them in terms of giving them a program and knowing that they will go on and crack on, and especially when you're with them as well. I mean, ultimately, there's also the reality of that they're 18, so they're going to go into the gym and they're going to do their own stuff as well. But the challenges I've found are more with the elite level in the fact that there's going to be a lot more questions asked around why we're doing certain things. So it's very important from my end to be able to have the rationale and have the justification of why we're doing stuff and what we're expecting to see. So there's been a couple of occasions where I've had the tests that we potentially will use criticised and saying, how does this relate to my performance? Like, if I'm slow, like, how is that? How, like, I'm not slow on court. So it's about then explaining, yes, I understand this, but for me, it's just helps the direction of the programme. It doesn't necessarily inform how good you are at playing your sport, but it allows me to have a look at, right, can I start to draw a golden thread between certain tests that will allow me to make the best informed decision of where we can go with your programme?
I didn't expect that, I'll be honest. I mean, after watching the Andy Murray documentary and the Last Dance, like, obviously that's the case because they're all divas at that level. But I just assumed the kids would be worse, but there you go. Chris, how about you?
Yeah, sure. So what made you want to get involved in strength and conditioning? Why would you say it's your passion and the thing that you've wanted to make your career?
So I guess when I finished, well, I was originally going to go up to Huddersfield and study music production. That was my first choice university when I came out of school. And I realised that I didn't actually want to go up and study music production. So
in Huddersfield.
In Huddersfield, exactly. So I started working at the school at the time, so at St George's College, with a company called Sport Academies, where I basically was coaching just loads of sports, and like, it was in the summer and I really enjoyed that. And then my cousin was, or still is now, a personal trainer, works in the fitness industry, and he started talking to me about strength and conditioning, and we went up to Lee Valley Athletic Centre to do one of the UK SCA strength and conditioning courses. And then from there, I kind of realised that, I actually working in elite sport, working with athletes to help them get better at their sport was something that felt that I could be very passionate about and want to jump in with both hands. So that's kind of, I guess, where it stemmed from.
So, like, you're talking about loving elite sport and all that kind of jazz. Why are you an Arsenal fan?
Mate, I ask myself this a lot.
Cool. Yeah, you don't feel like you have to ask that, Chris.
And now you're into it. Has it been what you expected? Like when you first started at WASP, was it what you expected to work with those players, or was it completely different?
Originally, like, especially my mindset when I was working at WASP, like, because rugby was my background, that was kind of the route I wanted to go down. Like, rugby was like the big thing, like seeing the guys at England Rugby, the strength and conditioning coach there was like very aspirational, like, oh yeah, I'd really want to get to that level. And it was very much like it was almost felt like a bit of an honour and proud to like wear the badge and everything like that. Whereas now I definitely feel that my mind has shifted away from working in a particular sport especially with being involved in tennis now. Like I didn't really have much interest in tennis before I got this role. And now it's very much that any future job that I would potentially get or want to go for, the sport wouldn't necessarily come into play. I think it's quite exciting going into different sports and kind of facing the different challenges that they offer.
So if it's not the individual sport and it's not working with individual athletes in particular, what would you say the best part of the job is? What is that thing that makes you come back for more every time?
The best thing is, hands down, watching what like. Being part of a performance program, so being part of a team where the goal is sports performance. So from a personal training level, I guess that's kind of the big distinction, that personal training, like you have your outcome goals and sometimes it may be sport, but in elite sport, it's all about game day. It's all about getting them ready to perform and being able to work with them through that process. And then especially with the academy, it was great at WASP, working with them through a season and then taking them to finals then, being able to watch them do stuff that we knew they could do and we've been watching them doing training. So I guess that's the same in tennis as well, like being able to work with them and do all the stuff that ultimately is going to allow them to get better and better and better, and watching them, like, again, being part of their successes and in some cases failures as well, like you learn.
I have to say, career-wise, it's got to be good for you if you're exposing yourself to like loads of different sports, because I suppose you'll have all these different nuggets of places you've tried things and thought, maybe that'll work for these guys, you know. Water polo and tennis, I suppose.
Yeah,
fundamentally,
exactly.
You're throwing ish.
Yeah, but what, again, like even that, like one's in water, one's on land. So,
with all the athletes you've worked with, have you got any key examples of any athletes that have progressed with you that you've gone, wow, they really improved over the time that I've worked with in a way that maybe I wasn't expecting, or they've improved in an area that what I wasn't expecting. They've become quicker, or they've become stronger in an area because of the work that I've done with them.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I don't think that as a strength and conditioning coach, we can always pinpoint the work that we've done to their performance. But I definitely say that the stuff that Tappers and what we did at WASPs with that group, so the Tom Willises, the Will Porters, Sam Simmons, Will Simmons, sorry, wait, if I called him Sam, and all those boys, like working with them from under 16s, under 17s, all the way through. And then obviously seeing the stuff that, especially on that finals day, I think there was a run Will Porter did where he took the ball in the 22 and just skinned through the whole team to score under the posts. Mm-hmm. And seeing that stuff, that's what we'd been doing in training as well. We've been doing not necessarily drills that replicate that, but we've been putting them in situations, chaotic situations where they had to learn those skills. And then to see that actually displayed in a game was pretty cool to see.
Should have maybe got them in the shops after they sort of started reopening post-COVID, like, and just say, you've got to go and get the flour, go.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll certainly make them sprint fast.
what about challenges, Charlie, before we leave that conversation behind? What are the challenges of your job, the biggest challenges? We've already talked about what you like.
I think now, especially in tennis, the biggest challenge is because it's partly a remote program in the sense that you're not necessarily traveling with the players that you're working with all the time. So there'll be a lot of time where you're actually not with the player. So it's trusting them and getting them to be compliant with doing the work that you're setting, and almost educating them in the sense that what I'm giving you is to help you, but also to get their opinion as well, especially because I haven't worked in tennis before. I need to be able to, I need to ultimately understand the reality of that, especially the higher level guys have been doing or have gained these habits however many years and seasons. So it would be unprofessional of me to come in and try and change that. But again, it's trying to get a picture and an understanding of what they're doing and how I can impact and influence them based on, again, like I said, what the coach wants as well. So I guess the biggest challenge is getting them to kind of be compliant while they're while they're away at competitions, especially because tennis is such a, there's not necessarily a season. The season is 52 weeks of the year. So it's trying to educate players that, right, because we need to be able to get certain doses of force, quality and max speed exposures into them throughout a week, and that might mean, like, on a day that you play potentially, if you, like, worst case scenario, if a player wins every single week and they're playing constantly, there needs to be some time in that week where they're getting exposed to a potentially high force stimulus or a max speed stimulus. So that's, I guess, the challenge is getting them to do that, and then getting them to do it to the level that they need to be able to do it as well, not just doing a run at 75%, like getting them to do three or four runs at 100% with adequate amount of rest, so we can get those adaptations that we want.
And working in elite sport, we all have to be okay with making mistakes and learning from them and getting better from them. Are there any big lessons that you've learned from what you've done so far?
Like, have you driven to Durham?
No, I haven't driven as far as Durham, but I guess the biggest thing for me is not making assumptions and always double checking and always making sure that I don't make any assumptions, because then it just makes everyone's life easier and it just allows you to be more on it. And
can you be more specific with the kind of assumptions you're talking about?
Yeah, so for example, if a player isn't reporting what they're doing, not to assume that it's been done, but they just haven't reported it. If it hasn't been reported, then I need to make sure that, well, not assume that it has been done and take it as, right, they haven't done it, unless I hear from them directly that, right, it has been done.
Maybe not trusting in some of those players as much as you'd want to then.
Yeah.
Just actually taking it, from their mouth rather than assuming it. What do you think the key area of development in strength and conditioning is at the moment? If you could pinpoint one thing that you think is going to really explode over the next few years as a key thing that everyone's going to work on and is going to really improve?
I think there's definitely a massive scope for a focus on actual coaching and, I guess, the art as opposed to the science of coaching. So how we coach and interact with people and how we get buy-in from players and how we get them to do what we want to do. And then from a technical point of view, I mean, it's hard to pinpoint exactly what's going to happen. But from my end, I'm pretty excited about, I'm pretty interested at the moment in this idea of specificity and how we can best select exercises to achieve the outcome that we want. So I've been... during my furlough, I've spent a lot of time reading, listening, watching videos, and having chats with people around this area and trying to, I still don't have all the answers and I'm nowhere near getting all the answers, but I'm starting to think in a way of, right, is what I'm doing having an impact? And I think that's a big thing that I think over the next 5 to 10 years will explode in terms of having questions and challenging people on, is what you're doing in your program going to affect the performance outcome and how sure of you that it can. And I think it's kind of, I think that for me, that's what I'm really interested in at the moment. Like, it'd be cool to see if that does explode over the next 5 years. You heard it from me first anyway.
All right. Well, we'll jot that down. Can you get, this might be pushing it a bit too far, but can you give us an example of like some specificity stuff that you would be considering, like between say a tennis player or a water polo player, for instance? Like,
yeah, I guess ultimately this, I mean, from a general point of view, the idea of specificity is largely at the moment, and again, from what I've read and over the last couple of months anyway, is being geared around what a movement looks like. So if you have running, for example, something that would be specific would be an exercise that looks like running. So it might be, for example, this could be quite controversial, but looking at something like sled running. So someone running with a resisted implement on their back, like, it looks like running. So therefore it's specific, but ultimately the fact that you have a sled on your back will change the inertial property of that mass, or the human that's running, the object that's running. Yeah. And it will change all the kinematics and the kinetics and how they do that as well. So there is some research that's come out over the last five years around the idea of having different loads will affect how the body moves under those loads. But as soon as you take the loads off, they'll just go back to what they were used to before. So I guess from a specificity point of view, it's taking it away from a specific exercise doesn't have to look like the exercise or the task that you want to achieve in competition. So a back squat could be specific to sprinting, or hip thrust could be specific to sprinting. If you're going after hip extension torque, for example, so it's dependent on how you look at it. But for me, it's trying to get away from, right, just because it looks like the sport doesn't mean it's specific, because ultimately, if you add a weight to something, you add a force vector. So it completely changes the mechanics of the movement. So that needs to be then taken into consideration. And then you've got to look at, right, is the adaptation that I'm getting from that actually specific? Because ultimately, it's the adaptations you get from training that are specific to the sport. So it could be, for example, like increasing the cross sectional area of your thigh, for example, will increase the potential to produce force in the acceleration start of a sprint, for example.
And because of those differences between the sports, do you think some sports find strength and conditioning more important than others? Do you think some have it, like for instance rugby, I know for instance would be more important probably because they've got to build more body mass and strength for it to start with. But you tell me, what sports do you think need it most?
Again, it's a tough question because I think there's an argument that there's an equal level with most sports, because you then can look from, especially from a tennis point of view, I could look from a point of view of, right, there's a huge amount of volume of serving in a set, and then potentially over a competition if they're playing. So it's then, right, how have you conditioned that shoulder to be able to cope with the magnitudes of velocities going through that joint? But then again, like you said, from a rugby perspective, there's obviously that size element, and there's a lot more to it, like especially from a conditioning perspective, being able to condition the player so that they can tolerate the impacts and the collisions and go again and again and again. But again, I'd probably go down the route of saying something like potentially mixed martial arts is probably pretty key, because if you're not, like, ultimately if you're not conditioned enough, then you get knocked out. And like, yeah, exactly. So but I think again it's massive. It depends on the context. Like I think ultimately there's an argument for most sports needing a decent level of strength and conditioning. Any sport in essence where there's a performance element, which is most of them, unless you're a recreational athlete, will need a very good level of strength and conditioning if you want to be top. Obviously you have your anomalies, you have your people who might be at the top of the game and have very little support, but again it's understanding that might be N equals one and they might just be the anomaly of the sport.
Yeah. Well, even at university dodgeball we had strength and conditioning given to us by the uni. So
yeah, mate, you'd be surprised. Like there's strength and conditioning coaches working in table tennis. There's an argument for it in most sports. Like if you can get your competitive advantage, and yeah, strength and conditioning might be where you can get that.
Do you think there is a limit that strength and conditioning can take the body to? Do you think there's a certain, yeah, it can go only so far? Or as a science, do you think it can always develop?
I think ultimately it depends on the athlete. The athlete will obviously, determined by their genetics, is going to be massively influence how far they can go for their athletic potential, for example. But I think ultimately it comes down to how good are they at the sport. Like I think ultimately that's what's gonna dictate whether they're in most sports anyway. Obviously you have like you like weightlifting and sports like strongman and powerlifting where that can obviously take you very far, and that in essence is the sport. But I think ultimately the sport is going to dictate how skillful you are. The sport is going to dictate where you go, and then as a strength conditioning coach, you just give them the physical capacity or that buffering of where they're working in. So if you can increase that buffering capacity, then obviously you can potentially reduce the risk of injury. And if they need to tip into that extra space, that they can do that.
And do you think strength and conditioning has a limit as something itself? Do you think it can always carry on improving? Because we're always learning new things about the human body. There's always a new facet we can make strength and conditioning better.
Yeah, 100%. I think understanding that the body is a complex system and we never know what we're going to get from, well, we can't be certain that if I was to do 5 sets of 5 on a back squat and you both were to do 5 sets of 5 on the back squat, we're going to get the same output.
I'll lift way more.
Yeah, but even then, like, we can't be 100% sure what we're going to get from a given stimulus. So, and I don't think we ever will get to that point if we understand that this body is a complex system, but with advances in technology, advances in research, I think we can have better educated hunches about what we're going to get, and we can be slightly more certain with more research behind it. I mean, there's not as much research in a lot of the fields on elite athletes at the moment. There's a lot on the recreation athlete, university athletes, and young, potentially older populations, but there's limited research currently around elite athletes. So I think that could be quite an interesting area to explore.
I'm sort of intrigued by the crossover slash disparities between sports science and S&C, because obviously I am a sports science graduate, but I've left that well behind now. Is that something you can talk about?
Ultimately, again, like even like strength and conditioning, like the terminology of the title in itself is questionable. I think I was like to imply that we just work on strength and conditioning, like I will take part in sports science practices on a day-to-day basis and do daily monitoring, wellness and all that kind of stuff. And we'll look at like at WASPs, I help look at the GPS stuff. So I think it's understanding that as a performance team, as a sports science and medicine team, we're an interdisciplinary team. Mm. I got it right there. So we're not necessarily different. We're not strength conditioning, sports science. We're all one unit and we're all bouncing off each other. To get the best out of the athlete. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, sports science, strength and conditioning, they're similar in the sense that they're both in the sports performance department. But I guess if you were to really get into the nitty and gritty, you'd probably argue that strength and conditioning is a bit more practical in terms of your strength and in a sports setting, your strength and conditioning coach will be your gym and your field-based practitioner, whereas your sports science will look after more the data side of things. But I guess in my role, that's kind of merged together. So we look after the data and do the strength conditioning as well.
Neat, two for one package, love it.
And personally, do you see your role changing over the next 10 years? Would you like to branch out into something else, or would you like to continue working in sports science and strength and conditioning over those next 10 years? What do you see ahead?
Again, it's tough. I definitely, at the moment, I'd like to be within strength and conditioning within the next 10 years. But again, like even if you'd asked me this question last year, I wouldn't have had a clue. I was personal training. I didn't anticipate that I'd be working where I am now. So anything can change, but I definitely would want to stay within sports, especially elite sports. I like the challenges of working in elite sports. It's very different to an academy setting. So yeah, I guess. And then from a tennis point of view, like really enjoying the challenges of tennis at the moment. So I don't have any plans on wanting to jump around as of yet, but again, if you'd never know what's around the corner.
Yeah. So as always, the best way to be is just open and ready to see whatever opportunities come your way.
Exactly.
And you've already proven that you're willing to do that in multi sports, so that's really good. Who have been some of your mentors in your career so far? You've mentioned Tapper's quite a few times. He might be high on that.
Yeah.
List.
Yeah. No. Tapper's definitely. And then I guess when I started out, all my coaching was massively influenced by Matt Church, who owns Locker 27, and then James Mealing and Alex Barnard, who were the coaches there at the time as well, who again massively shaped my philosophy around coaching, whether that was with youth athletes or my personal training clients. And then obviously I've said Tappers, James Honeyburn as well. So he was the Wasps head rugby coach. He definitely helped me understand like the importance of the actual sport and being aligned with what the coach wants. And then I guess more recently, Chris McLeod, who's my current boss at the Lawn Tennis Association, he's been very, very helpful with me and very good with me. And again, I do have a mentor as well in Tom Rusger, who's a technical lead at the EIS working with on the GB Power Rowing program. So I guess from an actual mentor side, he is my mentor. But again, there's loads of people I probably missed off this as well. But I've been very lucky that I've been able to pick the brains off some very, very smart people since I've been working in strength and conditioning.
And have you got any heroes in the field that maybe you want to try and emulate, that guys you know from previous that have been fantastic S&C coaches that you've gone, yeah, I want to be exactly like that guy, or stuff you could learn off them?
I wouldn't say I have any heroes, but I guess all the guys that I've just mentioned have been instrumental in kind of my development so far. So if I can be nearly as smart as those guys, that would be great. And I guess even, I know I give them a lot of stick, but my housemate, Richard Tucker, so I'll drop his name in there. He's been really, really helpful just in terms of just live chats. And I give him a lot of shit all the time. Sorry, I don't know, I swear on that. I give him a lot of stick all the time. But ultimately, he's been really influential and really helped me kind of think a lot more. So,
and the next one's a bit cheeky. As an exclusive for us, can you tell us who possibly could be the next big thing in British tennis that you may have seen?
Yeah, I'm going to say player I'm working with, Jay Clark. He's the one to watch.
Any particular reasons why he's impressing you?
Yeah, he's
because he's sick at tennis.
Yeah, he's very good at tennis, but he's got a very good work ethic as well. He's very driven, really good to work with. So, yeah, that's my name drop.
Nice.
Hypothetically, you're working at Arsenal as an S&C coach, and the head coach job comes up. Do you take it?
As in head football coach?
Yeah.
Hypothetically. Yeah, why not? I'd love to say.
They're scraping the barrel.
Yeah, literally they would be. I wouldn't have a clue what I'm doing, but yeah, why not?
Awesome. And then I suppose finally, like, as you can see over the camera, my guns are huge anyway, but for everyone else who doesn't have huge guns, what's your big tip?
Do a lot of bicep curls. Do a lot of bicep curls. Eat a lot of protein. There you go.
Oh, sweet. Awesome. Thank you, Charlie. That's been really interesting.
Mate, no worries at all. Appreciate you asking me on.
Thank you, chaps. It's at dugout_debate on all the social media and Facebook-y kind of stuff. See you soon.